Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems on the island of Maui. They've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now. Become a snack subscriber and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNuiVenison.com. And use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order. Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more. You know what my favorite text is? A waypoint in the Onyx Hunt app to a goblin turkey. The list on the Onyx Hunt app features for chasing turkeys is long, but knowing exact public and private boundaries and land ownership details will help you find more places to hunt, whether that's on public or private. I'll be toting the Hunt app through the spring woods in a few states this year, and I recommend you do the same if you want more turkeys on your table. Also, Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onyxmaps.com/hunt this spring.
I like getting in situations and being in places where I'm not thinking about really anything besides what I'm doing. I'm able to be completely in the moment. And I don't find that sense of peace and well-being and absence of distraction really anywhere else.
American wilderness is fascinating, ironic, and misunderstood. Today we'll discuss some of the criticisms of federal wilderness. The Bear Grease Academy of Backwoodsmanship, Philosophy, and Culture is back in session for one final episode. Wild places forged our national identity, and the peculiarities of American history made us handle these places differently than anywhere else on Earth. Understanding this forms an essential knowledge base necessary to navigate the modern issues of conservation and land management. And I'm also interested in how wilderness affects us on a personal level. And at the beginning of this episode, we'll talk with meat eater Steven Ranella about that. There are 111 million acres of federally designated wilderness in America, roughly 5% of American soil. There's a lot up for grabs, boys and girls, and there's never a long-term guarantee it's here to stay. I really doubt that you're going to want to miss this one.
When I hear many people talk about wilderness, they talk about basically void of human activity. It sounds picturesque and it sounds wonderful, but at what point does the void in human use and human management turn into the void of native ecosystem, flora and fauna flourishing there?
My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is the Bear Grease Podcast, where we'll explore things forgotten but relevant, search for insight in unlikely places, and where we'll tell the story of Americans who live their lives close to the land. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore.
This one is from Edward Abbey.
Okay.
Here's what Abbey says. Like D.H. Lawrence, I am taken by the primeval charm and fascination of the simple mysteries. Fire, building in mud, rain, sunlight, the smell of greasewood and live oak after a cloudburst, the luxury of a sleeping hound. I require space, openness, economy, natural existence, red meat, women, fire, water, the essentials of liberty. That's classic Ed Abbey, isn't it?
That was author and historian Dr. Dan Flores. That quote is a little racy for Bear Grease, and I even amended out a speck of vulgarity. But the focus on the essentials of human existence provokes thought, and it relates to wilderness. Abby was eccentric, but a spokesman for wild places. After the last two episodes, it's become apparent that wild places are essential to the idea of being human. It seems the very definition of humanity has become that we're separated from them. We came out of the wilderness. Nothing else did. Humans in wilderness are like light and darkness. One is defined by the absence of the other. Much of our series has been about policy, history, philosophy, and a bunch of this boring academic stuff about the dual nature of wilderness, the reality and the ideal. Brent acts like it's boring anyway, but he's dead wrong. And now, to kick us off, we're going to explore some more personal questions. And then we'll get into the criticisms of wilderness. There's going to be two segments, but here's the first. Meteor Zone's Steve Ranella talking about what the idea of wilderness means to him personally.
I'm a wilderness advocate for matters deeply personal. I'm a wilderness advocate for matters of humanity, okay, out of concerns for humanity. And I'm a wilderness advocate out of concerns for fish, birds, mammals, wildlife. They all intersect. But when I say I'm a wilderness advocate for matters deeply personal, I feel most enthralled, most engaged, most curious on what I consider to be a wilderness landscape. I'm more impressed by natural features, natural landscapes, than I'm impressed by anything made by man. I don't care about inventors. I'm not interested in technology for its own sake. I don't look at a phone and feel inspired. I don't look at a Tesla and think, wow. I'm never impressed by the gadgetry of man. I'm impressed by artistic creations, film and music and things, but I'm not impressed by the gadgetry of man. But I'm deeply impressed by the products of natural ecosystems. I love to look at animals. I like to listen to birds. I like to marvel at fish. I like to engage with these things. And on a wilderness landscape, it's the richest assemblages of those things and the lowest reminder of the absence of those things. So it's a form of perfection.
Wilderness is a form of perfection. I like the sound of that. The implication is that perfection comes from not being influenced by man. Ubiquitous across cultures, without exception, it's accepted that anything man touches becomes flawed. Perfection of natural systems is a powerful idea, and we'll learn that there are some real problems with the reality of wilderness, the actual land designation, because the preservation of wilderness itself is a man-made vessel prone to error. But I want to hear more from Steve about how interacting with wilderness tangibly impacts him. And we'll be coming back to this idea of being unimpressed with technology.
Wilderness does a lot for my sense of well-being, but it's not a panacea. It doesn't cure, it doesn't enable and cure everything for me. And I'll speak to that a little more fully. I like getting in situations and being in places where there's not a lot of room for ancillary thoughts in places that demand a level of focus or inspire a level of focus. If I'm on the North Slope, Alaska's North Slope, I'm probably doing something where I'm only thinking really about what I'm doing. I'm just engrossed by it. It doesn't help my craft as a writer because I don't care about writing and don't think about writing in that atmosphere. I'm not thinking about really anything besides what I'm doing. I'm able to be completely in the moment. And I don't find that sense of peace and well-being, an absence of distraction, really anywhere else. If I'm sitting out, you know, on the tundra or sitting on top of a mountain in the Rockies, and I'm sort of like, what am I going to see? I'm looking for wildlife. I'm just paying attention only to what's going on. If I'm with people, I'm paying attention to them too, but I'm thinking about sleeping that night. I'm thinking about eating that night. I'm just in it. I'm like in it, in the moment. I'm not thinking up book ideas. I'm just being there doing that. If I'm at my fish shack in Southeast Alaska, which is a marine wilderness, I only think about what I'm doing. We're catching fish, I'm thinking about that. We're catching shrimp, I'm thinking about that. I only think about what I'm doing. And I love that. I've joked before that the only other place that I've ever found that was riding my bike in Manhattan, where like riding your bike in Manhattan, you only are thinking about riding your bike in Manhattan. Because the minute you're not thinking about that, you're going to get hit. And I used to like to ride a bike through Manhattan just because of how much attention you had to pay. Which is, I'm only half joking when I say that. I just like those things that like demands all of your focus, demands all of your attention.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm cooking, as much as I love my kids and love my wife and love being in my home, when I'm cooking dinner at night, I'm ashamed to admit this a little bit. When I'm cooking dinner at night, I'm not only thinking about cooking dinner for my family in my home. Other stuff butts in. I can't. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why. If I was at my fish shack cooking dinner for my family, I'm probably only thinking about my family.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a unique space that not everybody can access on purpose. But how is that beneficial to you? Is it only beneficial in a moment of pleasure where you're able to escape these other tertiary demands on your life? Or does that time when you're in that space translate to you being more effective back inside of your life and other places or whatever?
It's only beneficial in the moment.
Interaction with wilderness is only beneficial in the moment. His answer surprised me, but I don't fully believe him. Not that I think he's lying. I just don't think he's giving his interaction with wilderness enough credit. Steve spends a lot of time in wild places. His ideas are way different than his buddy Thoreau, who believed wilderness was a reservoir of intellectual nourishment for civilized men. I found that in Roderick Nash's book. But I have to agree with Steve. I'm not immediately functionally inspired by wilderness. Aside from the raw pleasures and simple contentment of experiencing fear and discomfort, accepting physical challenge, engaging with wildlife, and the unexplainable satisfaction brought on by the perception of natural grandeur, and whatever intangible things are gained by the expression of awe. However, when I return home, I think I have a better, maybe even a unique perspective on my everyday life, my normal life. So wilderness does actually affect me beyond the moment. I think it does, Steve, too. Going back to what he said about being uninspired by technology, now that's interesting. Author Charles Hoffman, back in the 1800s, said that he venerated the hoary oak more than a moldering column. He was talking about European columns, back when we were establishing national identity, trying to make ourselves feel cool because we had wilderness and we didn't have big cities. I like it when a thought leader like Ranella says something revelatory and it opens your eyes. I never really thought about people being inspired by technology, but I think they are. And that might explain why I drive a 10-year-old dirty truck worth only 2/3 what my best mule Izzy is. And not to change directions too quickly, but here's an interesting thought from Ranella on the end of the world.
It's an interesting idea that you know, we'll run our course, right? We'll run our course, and humans will be gone from the earth, and then all this crazy stuff's going to happen here, mm-hmm. right? I'll sometimes look forward, like I kind of look forward to humans being gone from the earth, even though I won't be able to witness it. You know, mm-hmm. crazy stuff will happen here with wildlife. It's great to think about. It makes the destruction of the human race not quite as bad to think about if you think about how crazy it's going to get here all over again. Someday, you know, after that happens, I could see in centuries, thousands of years, it would revert back to a wilderness state. And then all of a sudden you'd see, like, you know, you're going to see chunks of what was a highway overpass. You know, the highways would get grown over, but you'll see, like, oh my gosh, like a highway overpass, you know, or something. But it'll revert, but it doesn't revert in any kind of a time frame that humans can comprehend.
Well, that's encouraging, Steve. I appreciate that. Actually, I mostly agree with him. All joking aside, and without a hint of religiosity, I want to give a criticism to modern Christianity. Why, say you? The Bible speaks of the end of time and the earth burning up with fire, and some have used this to minimize their personal responsibility towards ecological stewardship, as in, it doesn't matter because this place is going to burn up anyhow. But I don't think the writers of the Bible were implying to play it fast and loose with the earth. But rather, I read in the first two chapters a direct exhortation for wise ecological stewardship. Why is this relevant, you may say? Because Christianity's influence on American culture and history is unparalleled, rivaling any other institution. And that makes it relevant to an intelligent discussion. But I agree with Steve. There is a time stamp on the human race's tenure on this earth. We've used Steve Rinella as a test patient to mine down into the tangible impact of wilderness on his life. And with that, we're going to switch gears back to my original larger question of this series. Are American ideals on wilderness globally unique? And we're going to broach a bigger question of whether wilderness is still relevant to modern America. Here is Dr. Dan Flores.
Writing about things like environmental history, you also always have to ask questions like, so why is the United States the first country in the world to create national parks? Why are we the first country in the world to create a national park system? Why are we the first country in the world to create a wilderness preservation system? Well, the explanations all go back to this litany of things that we've been talking about, and they all sort of await, really, someone with insight, like Frederick Jackson Turner, to distill it in a simple form, the significance of the frontier in American history, and what the title doesn't say, but what you find out when you read the article is, the significance of the frontier in American history is that it created Americans. Mm. That's what the significance is. And so it's such a potent idea that it shapes the next 75 years of American history.
I think this has been quantified beyond doubt, but the American mind frame on wilderness is globally unique. Not perfect, just unique. Like Turner wrote in his 1890 essay, I believe that today, wilderness is still essential to the American character. Here's Alabama's first son, Hal Herring. If you listened to the last Bear Grease Render, you heard my vocal impression of this man. Here's Hal.
And I was thinking of being on the, what is it, the 405 down in California, you know? And you're just stuck in that 12 lanes of traffic. And not that far away from you is, you know, at least the Desolation Wilderness, which Jack Kerouac wrote about in 1950. He went there with Gary Snyder, you know, the poet. Like, this is so much a part of the fabric of our national identity. I mean, you don't have to go back to John Muir, you know, the grand old poet of the Sierra Nevada in California. You can go to Gary Snyder in the 50s. You can go to David Brower in the 80s. And all of that huge movement that resulted in the 1970s, like environmental legislation, these were people who were out in these wilderness areas in the United States. And they were forming a kind of national identity. You can go back to Frederick Jackson Turner and the frontier thesis, but it's still going on. It's still part of our national identity, maybe more so now than ever, that all these tributaries have kind of come together and created this river, that it's so obvious to us now that these places they're irreplaceable. There is no way to put a value on them.
Hal says wilderness is more relevant than ever to our national character. There is no way to put a value on it. I like that. However, nations change, identity shifts, and policy drifts. I'd like to see our society cast a gaze back to our roots, as conflicted as that can be. America's story of wilderness is odd and full of ironies. We became so proficient at destroying wilderness that we were the first to federally save it. Wilderness was touted here as a sacred cathedral, worthy to be preserved on its own merit, but it conveniently coincided with pragmatism. And most of our first wildernesses were rock and ice, and basically unusable. Wilderness itself is defined by the absence of man's intervention, but the reality of modern wilderness is that it's entirely man-made. America is known worldwide for our great cities and urban centers, but the wilderness defined our early identity. Isn't it ironic, don't you think? Ready to win Mother's Day and cement your reputation as the best gift giver in the family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. She'll love looking back on these memories and seeing what you're up to today. Even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep updating mom's frame with new photos, so it's the gift that keeps on giving. And this is not a joke. Juju Newcomb has an Aura frame, and we share photos, and they're incredible. Also, my mother-in-law has one. We have them. They truly are really good, really high quality. The Aura frame is easy to set up. It takes just 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app. It also adjusts the display depending on light levels in the room to maintain the true color of your photos. For real, the digital screen is amazing. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame when you use code BEAR, B-E-A-R, BEAR. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code BEAR at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time. Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more. Whitetail Institute launched the food plot revolution in 1988 with a concentration on research and real-world testing of forage products specifically for whitetail deer. Whitetail Institute's research and development team of agronomy experts provide effective, personalized service. I've been using Imperial Whitetail Clover for a long time in a food plot back behind my house. In 2007, I killed the biggest buck of my life over an Imperial Whitetail Clover small quarter-acre food plot. Imperial Whitetail Clover is the only clover scientifically developed through years of selective breeding. Clover Extreme genetic stability provides extreme cold tolerance, disease, and drought tolerance. It really does. Clover is coated with Whitetail Institute's Rain Bond, a polymer coating added for enhanced seedling survivability. They have an exclusive offer for Bear Grease listeners, 15% off Imperial Clover when you use the code BEAR at WhitetailInstitute.com. That's WhitetailInstitute.com and use code BEAR for 15% off. Now we're going to discuss some criticisms of physical and federally designated wilderness, not the idea. Here's author and professor Dr. Sarah Dant.
So one of the things about wilderness is that it has land management protocols that are the most restrictive, really, of public lands. You can't have mechanized vehicles. You can't have roads. You can't use machinery because it protects that original untrammeled definition mm-hmm. as best one can. But for a lot of people, the assumption is that wilderness is the land of no use. They value the public lands because there is that multiple use.
Right.
The national forests have a multiple use designation. So do Bureau of Land Management, BLM lands. Those have obvious uses that are tied to industries that people feel are in many ways iconic, family value kinds of things. Timbering, ranching, farming, mm-hmm. those are uses of the land that translate into commercial value, recognized value, and therefore, if you can't do those commercially recognized valuable things on those lands, then they're not valuable. They're right. worthless.
What about the argument of the elitist, like from a physical standpoint, like wilderness, you can't drive in there, you can't take a helicopter in there. So it narrows the usage of people to who are physically able to get back in there.
That's true.
What do you say to that?
That's true. And that is unfortunate. But I really wanted to play professional tennis. And it turns out I can't because I'm not able to do that. It's not going to be an experience for everyone. And there are places, there are public lands that we do make accessible to everyone, that we pave trails, we do all of those things. And there are those places, but I'm not going to get to the top of Everest either.
The issues of access and multiple use are some of the biggest criticisms of federal wilderness. Adam Keith is from Missouri. He's a professional habitat and wildlife consultant, and he has a podcast called Land and Legacy. Once he muttered something to me about wilderness with a capital W that made me spin around and furrow my brow. Here's Adam Keith.
When someone asks me about wilderness, I have so many follow-up questions because what exactly are we talking about? And you say, you know, that wilderness area. The definition I would use that almost say with a chuckle is a large tract of land that's unmanaged, because these are areas that, for me, when I see them, I get concerned about the future of that area. And I look at them from a standpoint of going, what is the natural landscape supposed to be here and what it is now? And, you know, coming from Missouri, born and raised, and now with my job, we work in 32 states from basically Montana to the Atlantic, and I get to see a lot of country, and I assist landowners in improving their property to try to add the most biodiversity on the property possible, so the most is specifically game species, but also non-game species can flourish there. And so for me, when I see these wilderness areas, the ones I've stepped on and been on, I almost cringe when someone says, oh, the wilderness area, because I'm looking at it from the lenses of a native landscape enthusiast and as a hunter, and I'm going, man, these areas are in dire need of some management, some disturbance, some sort of action to help restore the biodiversity that was once there.
Wait a minute. I thought wilderness was the poster child of biodiversity. What is he talking about?
So I look, you know, I love public lands. I've hunted a lot of public lands. But when I see these wilderness areas, specifically in the Midwest and East, I just have to cringe and say, man, they could be so much better if we were allowed to manage them the way the landscape needs to be managed. And when people talk about wilderness and we see kind of what the purpose was to exclude these, you know, four-wheelers and mechanical machines, no chainsaws. But we have to, I like to say, but let's also look at what's being excluded that was beneficial to the landscape from a natural disturbance. And specifically, fire is one of them that I really wish we could see more of. I'll take a very close approach, hits right at home. There's a large tract of national forest just a few counties south of me. and you have a large tract that is national forest, and you have a large tract that is wilderness, the wilderness being about 12,000 acres. And if you go to those two areas, you'll see entirely different landscapes. You go to the Glatop Trail where there's active management, you'll see these huge open glades, these amazing grasslands with dotted savannas around them, transitioning into woodlands with just incredible diversity. You might even catch an eastern collared lizard, which is kind of one of our rare reptiles here in the Midwest. And you might even catch a covey of quail. But you jump right across the road into the wilderness area, and you're going to see stark difference of unmanaged ground. And that is going to be chocked full of eastern red cedar. They historically take over the glade ecosystem. You're going to see lots of invasive species like Cerisa lespediza. Ultimately, you're going to see not a whole lot of these open, beautiful wildflower meadows that are within a mile away. It's just such a comparison for me to look at that and go, if I were to have to choose one, obviously I'm going to take the Glatop Trail with active management going on. You see more life there than you do at the wilderness.
Adam has seen federal wilderness, especially in the east, having a lot of invasives, having less biodiversity, and is actually less like pre-European landscapes than the more managed national forest, primarily because of lack of fire. But I think it's important to note that he's primarily talking about these smaller wilderness areas in the eastern USA, because some fire does naturally happen in the big western wildernesses, but it's often catastrophic fire. Smaller, more regular burns would reduce fuel loads and fires wouldn't be as intense. But this is all really complicated stuff.
When it comes to these wilderness areas, I think it's very unfair to assume that you can manage an eastern wilderness, say in North Carolina, the same way you would manage a wilderness area in Montana or Alaska. They're totally different areas, totally different ecosystems, different historical disturbances, and you wouldn't even manage your own farm, or you wouldn't manage the same way in the southern part of your state as the northern part of the state. So I think it's very unfair for us to believe that you can throw a label or throw up some signs and call it a wilderness area and have the same management across the board and expect the same results. When I hear many people talk about wilderness, they talk about basically void of human activity, talk about the ability to go and camp or walk and hike all the way through it, ride a horse and not run into major human activity. And it sounds picturesque and it sounds wonderful, but putting the lens of land management and natural native ecosystem restoration on, I say, but at what point does the void in human use and human management turn into the void of native ecosystem, flora and fauna flourishing there? A lot of people love the idea of wilderness. They love the idea of it, but if I could walk with every single one of those people through a wilderness here in the Midwest and eastern part, we would walk away on the same page. I'm convinced of it.
The real question here is, what do we really value about wilderness? Is it the physically untrammeled, uninfluenced by man aspect, meaning you don't see roads, fire breaks, stumps, and tire tracks? Or do we value pre-European biodiversity? It seems like it's really hard to have both. And this is a tough one for me. I don't like seeing roads. And even if they are gated, you know people will violate the law and unlawfully enter. Would any human management at all break the whole untrammeled aspect of wilderness that we love so much? What's more important to you, untrammeled or biodiversity? Think about it. Here's documentary wildlife filmmaker Ben Masters.
Well, I think that it's important to recognize that we are living in an extinction crisis in the world right now, and that wildernesses harbor one of the greatest hopes in conserving biodiversity. So if a wilderness area isn't managed for that natural habitat that should be there, for example, a ponderosa pine forest, which requires natural fire to go through that ecosystem, and instead that area is allowed to become dominated by an invasive species, then not only is that, I believe, antithetical to the purpose of the wilderness ideal, but I would also consider that to be a threat to biodiversity at large. Of course, we should manage our wilderness areas to promote native endemic species to that areas. And if that requires things like burn breaks or requires things like, you know, removing invasive species through mechanical means, then I am in full support of that. I'd like to think that we could take a hands-off approach, but like the whole idea of wilderness is very hands-on. Like that is a very human construct to designate a wilderness as a place free from humanity. But just the very political nature of how wilderness was created inherently means that it is this man-made thing. And I think that recognizing what that man-made thing is, we should manage it to be the best wilderness possible. And if that requires some intervention, you know, ensuring that that habitat is able to continue to exist into the future, then by all means, I think that we should intervene.
Ben's answer surprised me, but seems reasonable.
When we get into the wilderness and I start talking about this, I typically, depending on who I'm talking to, but they're ready to pitch me away because it's kind of, I'm not anti-wilderness. I'm not anti-public lands. I'm not any of that. I'm just pro-active land management. And I feel like a simple, you know, I'm not saying call up the lumber crews and the timber crews and get them in there and let's start cutting some wilderness areas. I think what we have to understand, my argument in simple terms, is can we reevaluate the management plan that we have currently? Can we reevaluate the terms that are put in place for the wilderness areas? Because there's too many invasives, there's too much catastrophic fire, there's too many wildfires, there's too many things happening in these areas that are causing a major decline in our game and non-game species, as well as the flora and the fauna. We're not just talking, I want more deer. I'm not saying that. And for just a simple solution, I'd say, can we use prescribed fire in these areas? Can we use them to help thin out some of the invasive species that are there? Can we help use the fire to stimulate new growth? There's a lot of trees in some of these wilderness areas that are sick, diseased, declining, and fire will help go ahead and kill them and free up that space for new life to grow up. And the other simple request I would have would be anything invasive species management. Once we identify the invasives that are there, can we go in and remove them through different means? Whatever the best management practice is for that list of invasives, that's what I choose to do. Could be a timed application of herbicide to remove the specific species. And I know I said the word herbicide and people are going to be upset about that, but we have to find solutions to remove these invasives or at least begin to set them back rather than just let them go crazy in our wilderness areas.
If we resurrected John Muir and introduced some type of invasive tree to the Yosemite Valley and took him there and said, all right, John, look at this valley. Here in 50 years, it's going to be completely dominated by this invasive tree and this ecosystem that inspired you so much to advocate for wilderness is going to disappear. What do you think we should do? Should we combat this invasive species or should we preserve the wilderness idea and take a totally hands-off approach? I think John Muir would agree with that sentiment that we should manage our wilderness areas for what makes them so special. Yeah, I think a hands-off approach is irresponsible.
A hands-off approach is irresponsible. I appreciate the certainty of his answer, and he's not wrong. However, I'm not sure I trust the system enough to let them change the rules. Is that reasonable? And to make a comment about the extinction crisis. As North American hunters, we, Clay, loves to talk about how well the 29 big game species are doing and how hunting has saved them. This is our stump speech. And sometimes I can be dismissive of environmental messaging because it appears to be politically motivated. However, as I pay attention to what's going on globally and in this country, This biodiversity crisis is real. Let's just take where I live in Arkansas. Pre-European settlement, there would have been insignificant numbers wolves, mountain lions, bison, elk, ivory-billed woodpeckers, and passenger pigeons. Only the pigeon and the woodpecker are extinct. The others just extirpated, but that's a significant chunk of biota taken off the landscape. And this isn't even including amphibians and insects. Thoreau, dadgummim, talked about the demigod that stole the stars and how he wants to see an entire heaven and an entire earth. The real question is, what do we value in wilderness? Is it simply no people or evidence of them? Or is it a healthy, biodiverse ecosystem? Here's Adam.
As a land manager and a habitat consultant, a lot of times we love to quote Otto Leopold and we love to read Sand County Almanac and just be mesmerized by his thoughts. And, you know, Otto passed away in like 1948. Another common name when you start talking Otto Leopold, you talk about John Muir, and he passed away in 1914. And, you know, these guys had incredible ideas of the landscape. John Muir, more of a preservationist mindset. Otto Leopold, you know, famously for his five tools of land management with an axe, a cow, plow, fire, and a gun. That doesn't sound like a preservationist, a wilderness type, even though he helped with some of the ideas of wilderness. And I think as much as I love Otto's work, there's one thing that I pulled away when reading him is his love for native landscapes, like just the wild, undeveloped land. And so when he talked a little bit about invasive species, but you know, it's a totally different world when you look at the invasive loads that we have today versus in the 30s and 40s. And I think if he were alive today, I feel like he would have to say, I think we need to reevaluate the management that we're doing in our eastern and midwestern forest, especially the wilderness, because we are drowning in invasives and they are in dire need of help. And right now, we can't do anything. But with this wilderness idea, it's like, let's just blanket it and call it a wilderness area. And now all we know is that no man's going to be building houses or condos or cottages there. It's going to be kind of left alone. And it's like, oh, no game manager in the country would say, I'm going to write a plan for now forever and leave it as is. There's always reevaluations that happen. And that's because we're trying to do what's best for the landscape.
The trouble with reevaluations when it comes to federal wilderness is, what if they change it all together? What if an open gate ends up with the whole thing being reorganized? Is it better to risk it with invasive species or fundamentally change the regulations on wilderness, risking larger scale changes? Is the federal system nimble enough to regulate different places under different rules? Can they be trusted? I do not know the answer to this. What do you think? Now we've seen some of the problems with wilderness, but what are the most real challenges they'll face in the coming generations?
I've had the opportunity to think a lot about wilderness. I recently had a daughter and a son. Birdie is 3.5, and Davis, my boy, he's 1.5 years old. I think about how our generation has inherited this amazing gift of wild places and of all the wonderful things that America has, the opportunity, the economic opportunity. I think that the greatest gift that we've inherited is wild places. And I think that that is the greatest gift that we can give our children as well. You know, looking 50, 100, 200 years down the road, that is going to be the most valuable commodity that the future has, is wilderness. And I think that it's foolish for us to assume that just because a wilderness area exists today, that it's going to exist 50 or 100 years from now.
I asked Hal Herring what the biggest threat to American wilderness is. Here's what he said. I sure hope he doesn't bring up America's greatest president, Ronald Reagan.
In the West, particularly all over the country, though, the United States, the people since Reagan have been taught.
Dadgummit, how I told you not to bring up Reagan.
That the federal government is the enemy. The most dangerous words in English language are, I'm from the federal government and I'm here to help you. You know, Randy Weaver, whatever, David Koresh in Waco, right? Like, and you're not going to find a more skeptical person than, of government power than Hal. That person doesn't exist. However, we have been carefully taught to despise and reject the federal government as a solution to any problems. And the honest answer to this is the federal government is responsible for the U.S. Forest Service and for the wilderness and for the designated wilderness and for all the American system of public lands. And if we continue to disempower, dislike, distrust, despise our own government at the federal level, we're not going to have these protections, and these lands are going to be overrun by people who seek to profit from them in the next 100 years for sure. So the answer to that is a very American answer, and it is that we the people, operating a government of the people, by the people, for the people, are going to have to choose at the federal level to keep these lands in public hands and federally managed.
Woo! How? That's interesting and insightful. As we come to a close on this session of the Bear Grease Academy, we've covered a lot of ground, but most notably, this series has challenged my views on American wilderness through one simple thing: knowledge. I just know more than I did before. I want to ask Dr. Flores one final question, and it pertains to knowledge, and it's more of a philosophical one. It's one I'm asking myself.
Has your attitude of wilderness changed?
Oh yeah, it's changed for sure. But so I understand much better the role of wilderness as a constructed idea,
yeah,
in the American mind in particular. One of the great things about learning new information is that it rearranges the furniture in your head. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, you can't ever go back. Your whole point of view is from a different angle on the world now. And I think understanding how wilderness got conceived and how it was altered by Romanticism and by Turner, Frederick Jackson Turner, and right, by the Wilderness Act and the whole notion of wilderness as a place where humans don't remain, mm-hmm, which was a complete misapprehension of what early Europeans actually were seeing in America. Right. That's all been modified by what I've read and understood, but somehow it didn't make me not want to live like this.
Yeah.
And it hasn't had any kind of impact on, I've got a chance to go spend 12 days floating down the Hulahula River from the top of the Brooks Range to the Arctic Sea through the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge with 10,000 caribou around me and packs of wolves hunting them. Right, I'm going to go do it.
I hope this series has made you evaluate how you view, interact with, and are influenced by America's wild lands. I believe understanding our cultural history is critical to having any objective and reasonable opinions on how it should be treated today, in the coming decades, and even coming centuries. I believe wild lands will one day be the most scarce natural resource on planet Earth. A day will come when men will crave to interact with them and will not be able to find them. That is, unless we can keep them wild. In many ways, that day is already upon us. Overall, I hope this series sparks a more effective passion in our hearts for wild lands in all their forms. I know that it's challenged me. It's rearranged the furniture in my head. In the end, it's clear to me that America does have a globally unique perspective on wild lands, and that's something to be proud of. We just have to make sure the wild places stay wild. Thanks so much for listening to Bear Grease. The spring is upon us, and we're about to get into some turkey hunting stories. Be sure to come out and see Brent and I on March 9th, 2024, in Bentonville, Arkansas, at the Black Bear Bonanza. We'll be there all day. And the Meat Eater crew is hitting the road again for a live tour out west in April and May. So look for some more info on that. I'll be there too. Hope you have a great week. Thanks again. This show is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. Around New Year's, we get obsessed with how to change ourselves instead of just expanding on what we've already done right. Maybe you finally organized one part of your space and you want to tackle another. Or maybe you're taking your supplements every morning and now you actually want to eat breakfast. In the last year, I've been more diligent about going to the gym on a regimented schedule, and it's made a lot of difference in my life. Therapy helps you find your strengths so that you can ditch the extreme resolutions and make changes that really stick. Therapy is helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/grease today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/grease. Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems. On the island of Maui, they've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now, become a snack subscriber, and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com, that's MauiNuiVenison.com, and use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order.